connect the dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your community, our society, and everything going on planet Earth. We talk about the different interconnections of different sectors because people live in different silos, they live in different bubbles, they live with different specialties, and it's really hard to get a both in-depth and very broad and interconnected view of the key things that are happening in our society. And in the 11 years since I have been doing this program, it's only become more and more and more and more essential, as we see every day, in terms of what's going on with our society, with our climate, with people and their mentalities, and of course with our political system. I'm a longstanding journalist covering climate, health, food, politics, policy, as well as media and popular attitudes. And each week on the show, we have different journalists, authors, activists, advocates, economists, filmmakers, nonprofit organization people, all sorts of people who are focusing on specific aspects of our interconnected world. On today's show, I am delighted to welcome Paul Street. He's an historian and author of many books, and as you'll be able to tell the minute I start talking about the books he's written, he's addressing a particular issue we have, which I think is one of really our crux issues in the tremendous troubles facing our world today. And, you know, it's something we've discussed before on Connect the Dots. You'll recognize it. And I think, you know, although there's kind of a thing out there where people are like, oh, don't speak ill of, you know, any of the opposition leaders, et cetera, because, you know, we have a real situation with Trump. It's really not enough to oppress, repress the truth, to silence ourselves, and to, you know, kind of treat political figures just like action characters that we have certain fictional ideas about without really examining on a deeper level what they're about, so that we really can confront and be prepared for and deal with what's happening and what will be happening next. As an author, Paul Street has written, They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. Another book of his from 2008 is Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. And then there's also The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power. Street is completing right now a book on Obama's deeply conservative response to the neo-fascistic Trump presidency. And his journalism can regularly be found on both Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report. And we've had writers and editors from Counterpunch before. And actually, we were trying to get main editor of Black Agenda Report, but we have had Danny Haifong from Black Agenda Report on our show before. And these are journalistic publications that I highly regard, as well as the journalists who write for them. And when people ask, well, what should I actually read to stay in touch? You know, I'd like to re-recommend Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report. And today we're going to hear from a journalist writing for both of them about, I'm titling the show The Inauthentic Opposition, because there's a perception in our two-party system that we have an opposition without really taking a more honest and painful look at what that opposition has actually accomplished and what it really represents. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Paul Street.
Thank you very much, Allison.
I think the kind of clarity in some but confusion in many around Barack Obama and his role is one of the central puzzles to be figured out and deconstructed and more widely known, if in fact we even can learn soon enough to do anything about it is another question. But, you know, we have an election upcoming where the anointed figure for the opposition candidate is Joe Biden, who is Obama's vice president. And I believe that many people still see the Trump administration as an anomaly and are hoping, against hope, for some kind of return to, quote, normalcy, such as some people fondly recall, and others really were looking underneath the hood and finding something else entirely under the presidency of President Obama. You know, how do you approach and deconstruct that, the Obama problem, really, for people?
Well, you know, let me head off one potential objection from liberal listeners from the beginning, which is that I guarantee you, if you're any liberal Democrats out there, you have nothing on me when it comes to opposing Donald Trump. I have steadfastly, consistently described this administration as neo-fascistic. I have been consistently for the last 2 years in the streets in Chicago protesting the Trump administration, including at the Trump Tower, on the south side, in the loop, on the north side, all over town. So there's no denial or confusion at all about the nature of the current presidency. However, that said, I am not one who thinks that Trump is an anomaly, or that he's been, you know, that he's been somehow mysteriously snuck into power through some sort of vast Russian conspiracy. I think he is the outcome of decades of corporate imperial takeover of the American political system, including corporate and imperial takeover of the Democratic Party, the so-called inauthentic opposition. That phrase, incidentally, belongs to Sheldon Wolin. That was his description, remarkable description, of the Democrats in the spring of 2008, when his book Democracy Incorporated came out. And the book came out in the spring of 2008, just as the country was going sort of just crazy about Barack Obama. And I must say that in that book, but I will make the same grandiose claim for my own book that came out about the same time, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics in 2008, which John Pilger ended up calling the maybe the only book that tells the truth about the nation's 44th president. Wolin wrote something very interesting in early 2008. He wrote, "Should Democrats somehow be elected, they would do nothing to alter significantly the direction of society or substantially reverse the drift rightwards. The timidity," Wolin wrote, "of a Democratic Party mesmerized by centrist precepts points to the crucial fact that for the poor, for minorities, the working class, for anti-corporatists, for environmentalists, for peace activists, there is no opposition party working on their behalf." Wolin said, "If somehow they sneak in to power again, the corporatist Democrats will work to marginalize any possible threat to the corporate allies of the Republicans." And you know, that and frankly, my book that came out in 2008 were just flat out crystal ball predictions of the next 8 years. That is precisely what happened under the Obama administration. And this book that I'm doing right now, which I was sort of a little bit ambivalent about doing about it first. I was like, really, another book about Obama? We're struggling with the Trump administration. And as I got deeper into it, it turned out to be just a marvelous, wonderful angle on and look into actually precisely the Trump administration and why there isn't an authentic and real resistance and an authentic and real opposition. And this cult of Obama is part of it. And one of the things that I'm developing in this book is a great irony. And the irony is that Obama's legacy is being burnished. It's being buffed. His popularity is being enhanced by the sheer neo-fascistic awfulness of a presidency that Obama himself helped birth and give rise to. I suppose someone could hear that phrase birth and accuse me of being a birther. Well, it's a different kind of birther altogether, not the fascist white nationalist birther of that is Trump, but the role of Obama in hatching this Trumpenstein, this nightmare presidency. And before I go back to you, let me just say that there is this savage, there always has been. I know Obama from way back because I was in the civil rights community in Chicago in the early 20th century. There's a savage disconnect between what Obama knows privately and what Obama says publicly. Now, we know from a documentary that came out earlier this year that Obama was on the phone to Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, and said to him privately, there's a candor with Obama. I know this actually personally. There's a candor with Obama privately that you'll never see publicly. But he said privately to Tim Kaine, Tim, you better watch it here. We've got to keep a fascist out of the White House. Imagine that. He publicly describes the Republican contender Trump as a fascist. He would never say that publicly. He has never said it publicly. He's painfully and pathetically accommodating and deeply conservative, very cautious in his remarks, and they're savagely timed to the election cycle, and even that's when he's most assertive, and even when he says anything, it's hedged in very indirect type of language. He doesn't want to use the guy's name. He certainly publicly will never call out the Trump administration for what it really is, which is a neo-fascistic phenomena. And, you know, my theory about that is that, among other things, that really acknowledging that might mean having to admit his own role as kind of a Weimar era prelude to Hitler. I mean, you know, at the risk of being overdramatic about things, and in fact, the title of the chapter that I'm doing on the Obama administration before Trump came in is Barack von Obamdenberg, which is a parallel with Paul von. I'm going to butcher his last name, Hindenburg. And who was the president who appointed him as chancellor. And, you know, that may strike many as overdramatic, but I'm actually quite serious about that.
How did he play that bridge role into the Trump administration when, you know, Trump accused him of being born outside the country, you know, ostensibly their enemies? You know, I think this is really the crux of the situation, is the public perception that they are adversaries, and, you know, the one is a kindly, well-spoken man. The other, you know, is speaks off the top of his head and lies with every word. You know, how can it be said that Obama actually helped shoehorn or, you know, create the shoehorn?
Well, I mean, there's the broad sense of that, and there's the immediate sense of that. And I'll tell you, in the immediate sense, there's this remarkable private comment where the guy knows that Obama understands that this is a fascist coming in. I mean, he uses that word. It's his word, right? That's not just some whacked out leftist like me. Knows he's coming in privately, publicly the day after the election. Well, first of all, the day after the election, in November 2016, and I'm in Iowa City at the time, and I mean, we're getting ready to occupy Interstate 80 and shut it down because we understand what's going on. This is not just your normal. This is not just your normal new presidency. Which, by the way, we did in Iowa City again after the George Floyd rebellion. But I digress. And so the day after he is elected, Obama calls in his younger staffers in the White House, all of whom, as you might imagine, are depressed, and tells them it's not the apocalypse. Don't worry about it. He says it's not the apocalypse. You don't have to worry about it. You know, it's just we're all. And then he goes out into the Rose Garden and he gives this speech to the basic lines in which are that this is an intramural contest. We're all on the same team. I spoke to Donald Trump last night, and I have faith in his commitment to democracy and freedom. And I'm going to do everything I can to help him along, because he actually said, because we're all Americans first. We're all patriots first. You know, and this is the standard pablum. This is the standard nostrums of Obama since his keynote address in 2004, right? There is no Black America. There's no red state America. There's no blue state America. There's just one America, the United States of America. So they actually said we're Americans first. Well, you know, you just take two letters out of that, and that's America first, you know, which is the fascist. So he plays along with that. So that's the immediate sense. And then ever since, it's just this incredibly deeply conservative, qualified, cringing, cautious response to Trump, even as Trump is blaming him absurdly and in clearly racialized kinds of ways for everything awful in the world. It's all Obama's fault. And literally going trying to erase Obama's legacy from American presidential history and dismantle some of his programs. And still, he can barely say anything. And when he does, it's very cautious. So, I mean, so that's the after the election and since. But then there's also what I do in this third chapter is the before, which is the shutting down of everything progressive and the demobilization of the progressive base in this country, you know, so that which just opens the door. You know, it's this ratchet effect. The further you move the Democratic Party to the right, the more you demobilize the base, and then the more you open the door for the right wing fascists, you know, because resentment abhors a vacuum, and the white nationalists and you know, the Tea Party refashions him under Trump and becomes white, full on white nationalist Trumpies. And you open the door for them. Obama played a really critical role. And that's what I'm tackling right now in this one chapter. I've been reading. And he's repeating that role now with Biden, who's about as awful and right-wing a corporate Democrat as one could ever begin to imagine, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's true. And there was a whole lineup of corporate Democrats. You know, and they were mostly there to jump on, you know, the first program up, Medicare for All. And then the second, the Green New Deal, they basically never even allowed it to debate. So the whole thing was like a whole, you know, incredibly bizarre performance. But I just want to go back to one point you said, which was demobilizing the progressives. The point you make in The Empire's New Clothes, and that you just made again, is that part of the goal is actually to demobilize progressives, to demobilize Democrats, to even demobilize Black people. Can you unpack
this is such a key point, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is such a key point, and it doesn't get enough attention. There's this whole mythology that Trump had this great big powering and surge of white working class votes. And it's not substantiated in any of the empirical evidence about that, actually. Really, Trump pretty much pulled out the standard Republican base. And actually, the voting base for Trump was a little bit more affluent than Hillary's base in 2016. A lot of the confusion about all this claim that Trump came in with working class is has to do with people completely identifying middle class with having a college degree. In fact, Trump had a lot of support from petty bourgeois people, you know, people who own car dealerships or building contractors that don't have college degrees, but they're not working class either. So there's a lot of petty bourgeois white heartland support for Trump, but the Democrats pretty much lost the election more than Trump wanted. He did, but Trump was elected with a quarter of the voting age population. Actually, I don't think a lot of people know that. And it wasn't particularly proletarian at all. Really, what happened is the Democrats, of course, Hillary Clinton plays a critical role, too. I mean, it really could have gone differently if Hillary Clinton hadn't been such an absolutely horrific and dismal, lying, lean, neoliberal warmonger with zero charisma and running completely on candidate character and almost not at all on policy, when she, in fact, was deeply unpopular. And this is a really critical mistake. And she made all kinds of practical mistakes, too, like not going to Wisconsin after the Democratic National Convention, not making ad buys in Michigan during the general election, all that. But you know, what gets lost in the story of 2016 with this whole narrative, which is mythical, of this great white working class uprising for Trump, is the demobilization of the base. And not just when people say working class, they always seem to think white or white working class, but the Black lower and working class. And you know, in key battleground states, that had cities with significant black populations. Milwaukee, the north side of Milwaukee, Cleveland and Cincinnati in Ohio, Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, Raleigh and Charlotte, North Carolina. I mean, these are the only states that really matter in our insane electoral college system, right? And all kinds of reports came out of blacks figuring, well, what's the point here? We had the ultimate symbolic victory, right? A technically black individual, right? In the White House, in the land of cotton slavery. It was intoxicating for many people. I always understood that. There was a reason for that. You know, at one level, it's just a really, really big deal. But we had this incredible symbolic moment of a technically black individual in the White House and nothing changed. Black net worth continued to collapse. There was a significant decline of black socioeconomic status under the Trump administration. So these interesting reports came out that no one ever seems to want to talk about the demobilization of the black electorate in 2016, not just because of Hillary, but in part because of the Obama experience. And, you know, I might also add, too, that racist voter suppression in the battleground states and across the country was and that's Republicans, in large measure, was a much bigger factor than Russia. I mean, 500 times over in determining the outcome in 2016. That's another thing. It's just amazing how little Democrats really say and do about that issue. You mentioned in introducing me, my friend Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford has this great line. He calls it a gentleman's agreement. There's a gentleman's agreement between the parties to permit the suppression of the black vote. And that happened again in 2016. It's amazing to me how little people talk about the black vote as well getting demobilized in 2016.
Well, you know, it's...
I'm so glad you mentioned that.
It's kind of a funny thing because, you know, I think liberals and white people can feel that they are being racially open and tolerant and everything and welcoming by voting for Obama. But he's really allied with their interests. And, you know, they are the last people to notice.
And this was something I tried to warn people about, and that's because I was from Chicago. I had to work with Obama. I was a research director at the Chicago Urban League, believe it or not, for many years. And I was always struck by how white-pleasing he was. And I was in Iowa City at the time of the Iowa caucus and at the time of the 2008 election, and I never ceased to be amazed by the disconnect between the white middle-class liberals. There's campus town, University of Iowa, I guess it would call itself progressive, and all the white middle-class people want to pat themselves on the back because of their readiness to vote for a technically black presidential candidate. But then you tell them, well, do you know that Iowa has the highest racial disparity and mass incarceration in the country? Didn't care. A black guy got shot down in the streets by a Johnson County sheriff, a guy named John Day, in 2009, and the town could barely muster a hint of a sliver of an inkling of a civil rights movement in response to it, you know, or do anything about the growing oppression of the ghettoized black population on the southeast side of town. So, yeah, they loved a guy who connected with their professional class self-identity, Harvard Law, adjunct professor at University of Chicago, articulate, eloquent, all the smooth, carefully crafted talking points. They love that. And he's black to boot. It almost became part of a reverse identity politics for them. Hey, look at me. We're not racist. When you come to substantive issues, institutional racism, structural racism, really nothing. It's just crickets. They have anything to say about that? And, you know, all through his presidency, I meant to say this before. I'm going to go back to you in a second. Obama consistently played the game of blaming blacks for their own disproportionate presence at the bottom of the American class structure with the personal responsibility narrative again and again and again. He'd get up and lecture blacks and tell them that they were buying into the notion that working hard and studying for school is acting white, you know, and he would accuse them basically of having a culture of poverty and of creating their own misery, you know. Even as the, you know, the financial sector was tearing up black mortgages and destroying black net worth, he was doing that, you know?
That's pretty
I call Obama an objective white supremacist, and I know that pisses a lot of liberals off, but I'm quite serious.
Well, how do you, like, just taking kind of a side turn here for a moment, you know, with the Black
sure.
Lives Matter movement as is currently occurring, you know, basically this is people going directly to deal with violence, the police, white supremacy, racism. They're taking to the streets and they're taking down icon after icon and statue
sure.
after statue. And as this happens, you know, there's a kind of silence among, I mean, there's no mention of Obama. You know, is there, have you?
That's very interesting. Yeah, they're not, you know, that's, you know, I'm in Chicago right now, and I went back down to the neighborhood that I grew up in, Hyde Park Kenwood, the other day on a city bike, one of these divvy bikes.
Yes.
And I came back into the loop up past north of 47th Street. Now, this was a neighborhood that I never would have stepped foot in when I was a kid in the 60s, but it's gentrified. And I kept going up. And here was a black gentleman selling T-shirts, all these Black Lives Matter T-shirts. And I bought a couple from him. And I'm looking at one right now, and it's really quite emotionally moving. It's a remarkable T-shirt. And it has a picture of George Floyd. He's got his, believe it or not, his hand on the shoulder of a kneeling Colin Kaepernick. He's got a young
wow.
woman, George Floyd does, in his left arm. And then behind him are the photos of Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, and Malcolm X. And we were talking, and I said, "Oh, you don't have Obama in there." He goes, "Yeah, no, nobody." He said, "Nobody, you know, we're done with that. You know, that happened. That's over. He didn't do anything, you know." And this is a return to How Black Chicago. I should tell some of your listeners, since I was at the Urban League in 2000 through 2005, this is a bit of a return to How Black Chicago felt about Obama before. But before Obama was anointed, he was not particularly popular. He got his butt whooped by Bobby Rush in a congressional race. He was viewed as University of Chicago, Harvard Law, white. Of course, he wasn't originally from Chicago too, and that was always a thing. But he wasn't viewed. And then he became anointed, and the symbolic thing took off, and he was in the U.S. Senate and the keynote address and all that. And changed for a while, but now they're kind of back to that. Now, you know, Obama has this line when he spoke out forcefully. He gets his rhetoric will increase as the general election comes closer. And he got a lot of credit from liberal reporters. One of the funny things in my research is that how much reporters want to think that he's speaking out forcefully against Trump when he really isn't. And you actually read his speech and you see the reporter's headline was really misleading. But so he got a lot of credit because he went down to Urbana, Champaign before the midterm elections in 2018. And I found this line in there. And it's a recurrent line in Obama. The way to protest is to vote. That's when you have the power, right? He says it all the time. That's when, no, wrong. Howard Zinn is right. It isn't just about who's sitting in elected offices. It's about who's sitting in the streets, in the workplaces, in the offices, in the public assemblies. You know, that's when history changes. That's how the New Deal happened in the 30s because the working class rose up. That's how the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act happened in the 60s and, you know, and all of that because people took to the streets. You know, and since George Floyd, he's kind of said some nice things about protest and all that, you know. But basically, he's all about channeling everything into that 2 minutes once every 1,460 days when we get to make marks next to the names of candidates selected in advance for us by the concentrated power, wealth and power structures.
So on the one hand, we have he's set in place and he's
but not Bernie Sanders
manage this demotivation by not giving the populations who are needing this help the help they need, and instead, you know, feeding that big into the, you know, the 1% and all of that. So he's demotivating voters, and then he's using the a call to vote in a suppressive manner by saying, this is all you need to do. So that's actually paradox.
All you need to vote, but by the way, I will work behind the scenes to make sure that the candidate who would most definitively kick Donald Trump's ass, i.e. Bernie Sanders, I will work quietly and behind the scenes and pretend I'm not, but everyone on the inside knows that I am. I will work to make sure that the candidate won't be Bernie Sanders, who's actually running in accord with majority progressive opinion on numerous issues.
Right. So then when he's saying,
even to the point of putting forward a guy that by mental health professionals that I know, by their estimation, is actually into dementia. I mean, that's a controversial assertion, but that is my assessment, my layman's assessment. I think Biden is a severely damaged candidate. Here's a little dirty secret about the corporate Democrats. Okay, yeah, it's not specific to Obama. The dirty little secret about the corporate Democrats, and it's not specific to Obama, it's across the board. This is Rahm Emanuel. This is Dick Clinton. They would rather lose to the right-wing party, even as that party becomes full-on apocalyptic and white nationalist, than lose to the moderately social democratic left-wing of their own party.
Well, you know, that's been a kind of belief and an assertion of the progressive left throughout the last, cycle. Right. And the concern has been that people will become so demotivated and they won't be remotivated necessarily by having, other liberals come on and, try to beat them into voting for the candidate because Trump is terrible, which of course he is. But Trump gets worse and worse, it becomes harder. I mean, A, there's more of a drive to get rid of him because, he's threatening everyone's lives with his non-existent health care policy in response to the pandemic, for one thing.
Oh, my God.
It's all his policies.
Every day. It's whack-a-mole. I can't even keep up with the horrors of this presidency.
Really? So then it makes, even under these circumstances, in fact, it then becomes that it looks more likely that Biden, even if they had to carry him in on a stretcher, and I agree with you about it, the mental health assessment, and that also comes from professionals with whom I've spoken, cognitive specialists, those kinds of experts
sure.
and stuff.
Yeah.
Say that publicly, everybody's like, oh, no, we'll have Trump and everything.
Well, you'll get accused of ageism, which is just absurd,
All of the top candidates were over the age of 70. But the thing is, it becomes, I think, harder for people to remember and believe that the Democrats, even in the case of what is, now moving closer to fascism every day, we don't even know if we'll have an election or if it won't be meaningful or anything.
That's such a key point. That's such a key point. I think you're absolutely right about that. Or if he'll accept the outcome of an electoral college count that doesn't go his way.
Yeah. I mean, we're heading down a very slippery slope, and what your statement implies is that even though perhaps they did not wish to see it go so far, they are in some way colluding with it, or did they perhaps wish it to go this far? In other words, is the question, and maybe we have no way of knowing, so I hate to put you on the spot, but is the deconstruction of our country, which we're now experiencing, we're not only witnessing it, we're experiencing it in our daily lives, is that something that the opposition party, the inauthentic opposition party, to use Wallen's term, has kind of tacitly or, directly but secretly signed on for? Are they part of this? Because certainly, I would say the one group who are not viewing the Democrats in the, naively but ineffectually good intentioned light would be, some of the libertarians and other people. They fully see to the point of favoring Trump, which I certainly don't and I don't support. But you know, they kind of see through the Democrats. But do you think the to that far an extent, do you think that the Democratic Party is actually on board with what's going on now?
Well, you know, I think to some extent that may be the case. I mean, there is this kind of sense of garnering advantage from how awful things have become under Trump. I will say this, that for 3+ years, they managed with the whole Russiagate thing, you know, to divert media and public consciousness away from the worst crimes of the Trump administration. Now, I'm one who thinks that I do find Trump very odd with regard to Russia. There is something very strange. I get that he has an authoritarian connection to, that he has a felt connection to authoritarian leaders all over the world. But there's something very odd and distinctive about his captivity to this Rasputin-like figure, Putin. I think there is something going on with that. I do think Russia had its geopolitical reasons to try and make some interventions in the political process. I don't think they were particularly significant. I do think Trump committed impeachable offenses vis-a-vis Ukraine. Granted, I just think he did. But those offenses, very much like what led to Nixon being pushed out in the 1970s, are the least of his crimes. And Trump's worst crimes, by far and away, are all the racist, nationalist. How about kids in cages, right? You know, how about violating international asylum law? I mean, all this, the COVID stuff is just completely insane, calling it a hoax. And I mean, I don't even want to get into all of that right now. But if you ask me, actually, the worst crimes of all, what makes Trump, in fact, what Noam Chomsky called him, the most dangerous criminal in human history, and that's a remarkable thing to say, is his dedicated efforts to tear up every environmental regulation that he possibly can and to accelerate the process of turning the entire planet into a greenhouse gas chamber. I mean, that's worse than Hitler. That's an assault, literally an assault on the destruction of organized human life on planet Earth. That's what he and Bolsonaro and Scott Morrison and other people like that are doing with Trump in the lead. And there's been crickets about this as the media has obsessed over Russiagate, which, among other things, is such an obsession, has been such an obsession for the Democratic Party because of their deep commitment to an imperial foreign policy in Eastern Europe. And that would be complicity to focus, to do everything they can to focus things on Russia while this guy introduces fascism. That would be, it strikes me, as the very definition of complicity, to destroy the candidacy of the guy who's running, the most popular Democratic candidate, who's actually running in accord with majority progressive public opinion for things like single-payer health insurance, a Green New Deal, progressive taxation, free public college, the restoration of union collective bargaining and rights and all that, to destroy that guy, who's not particularly radical, certainly not as radical or left as I am. I'm referring to Bernie Sanders. And to promote, frankly, a buffoonish gaffe machine who may be well into dementia, who led the charge on the Democratic side for the invasion of Iraq, who's just an open corporatist tool of the credit card industry, you know, that's complicity. So, I mean, that's enough for me to call it complicity, and furthermore, to try and capture and pour everyone's legitimate popular anger into electoral channels when the election may not happen, when there's clearly going to have to be a struggle in the streets if Biden wins, and if it's close. I mean, you know, Barr is going to tie it up in the courts. Trump has been seeding the narrative of not accepting the outcome from the beginning of his presidency. I mean, I personally don't think we can wait till January 20th, 2025 for the removal of the Trump administration. It is an existential menace now, and it needs to be forced out like the Puerto Rican people forced out Ricky Rossello last year. You know, I'm de la gens. I'm Howard Zinn. I'm about the politics of the streets, and I don't think we can survive much more of this administration. It sounds like a crazy thing to say. I completely understand why somebody in a contested state is going to, and I would not, if I was voting in a contested state, I might have to think about it myself. I get it. You know, I mean, I can't sit around and call the Trump administration neo-fascistic in essence and then not understand why someone would want to vote it out, to do what little they could to vote it for their 2 minutes, you know, to vote it out in a battleground state. So I totally get that. But I'm very skeptical of whether the electoral system is going to save us at all.
I hear that. You know, the whole situation is with all of these various elements. I mean, you know, to me, it's kind of like it could be, you know, it's super critical. I mean, we're getting into super critical territory, right? You know, so the whole idea that we have, you know, years to slowly fix the problem, whatever the problem is, when we have this, you know, particular negative synergy of all of these, you know, as you mentioned, climate, health, the economy, the political system. I mean, the you know, verging into fascism. You know, even
I think
just
the last month. I think the last month has been critical.
I mean, it's hard to
go ahead.
You know, he's now withdrawing from WHO, and he's declared that you know, COVID is kind of resolved, when everywhere else, you know, basically all the data shows that in fact we have a rise in concentration here. You know, in like something like 39 states or whatever. So, you know, and people are kind of like, well, I want my social life. I think that, you know, or whatever. I want to jog, you know. Jogging is great. Social life is great. You know, I know how everyone feels and everything. But, you know, I don't think the abbreviated timeline of complete conflagration that we could be on, I don't know how many people really perceive that. I'm really glad to hear you articulate it.
I've got a line somewhere in my book, or maybe it was an article I did. I can't even remember. But I this haunting line from Obama to his staffers the day after Trump has been elected. Calm down. It's not the apocalypse. I don't believe in the apocalypse until the apocalypse comes. And, you know, sort of it's like, hey, Obama, is it here yet? What is that point in time? When are we... when are we at the apocalypse? This is apocalyptic now. And
yes.
The last month has really been critical. The open embrace of fascist aesthetics at Mount Rushmore, I suppose that's something that people who aren't attuned to cultural history are going to miss. But it's just absolutely extraordinary. It was a very Third Reich-like event that was held there. Just the lighting and the symbols that were used behind Trump, a speech the next day with clouds of smoke of military imagery behind him. The call for the use of federal troops in response to the George Floyd rebellion, serious discussion of invoking the 1807 Insurrection Act on a national scale, the brutal military police state clearing of Lafayette Square, and the clumsy Bible-holding incident in front of St. John's Parish, just a clear nod to his Christian evangelical fascist base. The reference to Black Lives Matter as a symbol of hate, the doubled down defense of memorials and flags of the slave owners' Confederacy. Clearly, he's doubling down on white nationalism. He's decided that this is his ticket, is to completely double down on white nationalism. And this while saying that the virus is 99% harmless, which is just public health insanity. and now pulling out of the WHO. It's like, hey, Obama, can we take to the streets yet instead of just, you know, waiting for our little opportunity to mark a ballot, you know, to mark Joe Biden's name on a ballot?
God, when you, you know, I'm kind of at the intersection of where I have come from the white privileged circles, you know, that were in love with Obama. And I've been, you know, I was radicalized concerning him, especially by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I covered, you know, from around 2014 on. And even, and, you know, coming out of covering fracking and climate and all of that, but even the environmental community was quite asleep about the TPP, which basically would have destroyed all our liberties. It would have ruined the climate. It would have taken down a massive amount of rights. It would have taken down health care, the food supply. These are, you know, the kind of nexus of areas that I've covered. And yet people were so intoxicated by this charismatic figure of Obama that it kind of was waltzing right into place. And it was really only his brazenness during an election year, which really undermined, I think very seriously undermined Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Not that I'm a fan of hers, but she basically it was against her own history of championing the TPP and allied deals that she kind of had to get past in order to appeal to voters. And she did a very tepid job of it, both because of her own allegiance to it, as well as allegiance to President Obama, who was actively campaigning for it. So, you know, between the two of them, I actually think they subverted, and I was saying it that year as well, subverted her candidacy. And yet, you know, there's been this, you know, huge, I think Americans are so celebrity and personality driven that it's kind of like, well, we like this action character better than this one. And, you know, the full ramifications on human beings of all that each of them do is not, you know, kind of fully clear to everyone. I mean, ostensibly it was the, you know, the kind of older black vote in the South that helped take Biden's moribund candidacy, you know, kind of in back into play with the notion that loyalty, you know, and a wish for return to Obama was really a major factor in Biden in the revival of what had become a dead candidacy. I mean, do you think that now with what's advanced in terms of, you know, Black Lives Matter, people are still indulging in that same nostalgia today? Or do you think that's shifting? You know, the Obama
it's still sort of fairly widespread, but I wonder, you know, like I said, this guy on 43rd Street was like, he didn't do anything for us. You know, I guess I don't really have a read on that, but there's a certain amount of understandable nostalgia for the Obama period simply because it wasn't the Trump period. But what people aren't getting is how the Obama phase led to Obama and not just Obama, but the neoliberal, cringing corporate electorist politics of the Clinton, Obama, Schumer, Rahm Emanuel tendency gave rise to Trump. And you know, so it's entirely possible that Biden wins. He could win by a big margin. I think if he wins by a small margin, that it gets contested and tied up in the courts, and we really have a hell of a situation on our hands. If he wins by a big margin, it's possible that Trump will leave peacefully. It's entirely possible that Biden gets in there. But I'm concerned about the repetition of the same cycle, the fake progressivism, the failure to do anything that the silent progressive majority wants and desperately needs: universal basic income, progressive taxation, how about triple the minimum wage. I mean, just go through the list of things that people want and in fact need. Doesn't do any of them, demobilizes the Democratic base, opens the door for something that'll make people nostalgic, as bizarre as that might sound, for the Trump era. Because when you want Trump, When I say he's a fascist, I would say it in that he's an instinctual fascist. I don't know that he's capable of doctrine. I do believe that he probably read that book of Hitler's speeches that his first or second wife told us about from Vanity Fair many, many years ago. And I suspect that's the only book he's ever read. They say he couldn't even read a part of the second article of the Constitution for a publicity op. He couldn't get past two sentences, you know, without becoming frustrated. He's just not capable of doctrine. Stephen Miller's capable of doctrine. Steve Bannon's capable of doctrine. William Barr is capable of doctrine, but he's not. I'm going to tell you who is, who's capable of being a real white nationalist, quite self-consciously and being silver-tongued and articulate about it at the same time, is Tom Cotton, who I believe is Arkansas. Tom Cotton, who the senator from Arkansas, who published an op-ed in the New York Times after the George Floyd rebellion, calling for the Insurrection Act to be invoked and the deployment of the federal troops in American cities. Tom Cotton is a Harvard law graduate. And there's another guy whose name escapes me right now, who's a white nationalist, from Missouri senator. He got Claire McCaskill's seat in the last election. I wish I could remember his name right now. He's a Yale law graduate. And these people are fascists, and they actually know how to talk and plan and coordinate, you know, on a relatively high level. There's a clownishness about Trump that has always cloaked his fascism. And it's just a stupidity. I mean, at the end of the day, he's venal. And he's a malignant narcissist on steroids. He's not capable of real fascist doctrine, but other people come along, maybe. And that's when you're really be. And I'm afraid that the Biden thing, that's why we have to have a separate other politics other than the inauthentic opposition parties, electoral politics. And if Biden gets in, he's going to have to be forced to the left. I don't know if that's possible. I don't even know if that's doable by people in the streets, or else you're going to have something worse than Trump. I mean, genuinely apocalyptic going forward.
Well, that's sobering. I'm, you know, actually grateful to you, you know, Paul Street, for saying that on the show, because, you know, everybody is looking at Trump, understandably so. I am too, you know, praying for his downfall and kind of kind of restoration after that occurs. And it's not looking too bad because of, you know, a number of factors of the economy, the way he's blown, you know, the COVID situation and all the rest of it. But I think the thing that people don't remember very much, which you're pointing out very strongly, which is that, you know, we have another weak, colluding Democratic administration, and we go, whew, collectively, but that still isn't ready to meet people's needs, the needs of the ordinary people, rather than the corporations getting their bailout in this desperate
time. Oh, yeah, the Democrats signed on with this epic bailout of the corporations with no caps on CEO salaries or investment income. Yeah, they signed off on it.
Yeah, and they'll continue.
And they call the guy a lunatic and a psychotic and a malignant narcissist and everything else. They're correct about that. And then they give him surveillance powers and Pentagon budgets that are record-setting. You know, that's collusion, too.
So, you know, and then so the idea that, oh, we're home free if they're in office, where these same things, you know, it's kind of like they're passing the ball back and forth, you know, in terms of who can make it worse. You know, everyone points to the fact that, for example, now that thankfully the Dakota Access Pipeline has been struck down in court after a four-year battle, everyone's pointing that, you know, Trump is.
Yeah.
But, you know, Obama wouldn't stop it. So, you know, I think that's a perfect environmental example of, you know, how the one passes the ball to the other. And so you're pointing out that in these desperate times, we're not home free at all. And we still have the pandemic happening. So
you know that, you know, Obama, I think it was 2 years or so into the Trump administration, went down to Rice University wearing a tuxedo, talked to a bunch of oil executives and boasted about having increased domestic oil and gas drilling and production from them. He said, you guys want to, you know, you want to hate me? Forget about it. I did that. I expanded it. So he's proud of it. He's proud of it.
Well, you know, he was signing backstage portions of the TPP, which were taking down the environment in the same week that, you know, they passed the Paris Agreement, which had no concrete agreements about the changes. They were all voluntary.
After Obama had undermined Copenhagen, people forget that, in 2011. He just flat-out undermined efforts at binding global carbon emissions, you know, limits.
You are absolutely right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's... Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to look at other than somebody's shiny personality. You know, we're coming down to the last 3 minutes of the show here, so I just want to, you know, kind of wrap up, but also say that I look forward, Paul Street, to having you back on the show when your new book is upcoming, which I gather will be at the end of summer, this fall, something like that.
We want it out before the election. I think an early draft title idea was Plunders, Obama Plays. That's a bit of a reference to the affluent lifestyle that Obama's been experiencing since Trump came in. But I don't know if that title is going to stay. Might. And yeah, it should be out before the election. And I think it should get some readership because a lot of people are curious. It's interesting. They're like, what's he been doing? What's exactly going on with this guy ever since Trump came in? And I'm going to answer those questions.
That's terrific. Well, we're going to have you back on again for that. And in the, you know, in the meanwhile, listeners, you can look up Paul's other books, They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, and, of course, the book we've been discussing a lot today, The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power. You know, thank you so much for being with us, Paul Street, on today's Connect the Dots. Listeners, you can also find Paul's journalism on Counterpunch and the Black Agenda Report, both highly recommended. This show, now that it's completing its live broadcast, will be available in the Connect the Dots archives. If you've enjoyed the show, please later this afternoon or tomorrow, look it up, and I'll also be posting it. ConnectTheDots.podbean.com is where you'll find this show. You can please like us on iTunes and share it with your friends and social media. Thank you again, Paul, for joining me and the Connect the Dots audience today. It's been great having this conversation with you and learning so much. Thank you for your years of work in tracking this. Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.